Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage and get a secure, transparent home loan approval in minutes. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In many ways, the judgments of the United States Supreme Court set the frame for American life. The tenure of President Donald Trump could see a change in that frame. His first nominee, 49-year-old Judge Neil Gorsuch. He's being grilled this week in Senate hearings. What are we learning on Roe v. Wade, dark money, torture, judicial independence, corporate power? This hour on Point, Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch in the hot seat. You can join us on air or online. This conversation is always on. Should he be confirmed? And what is your sense of the nominee? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Past was prologue to these hearings all week long. They're going on still today. Right off the bat on Monday, we had Republican Senator from Texas, John Cornyn, complimenting the Supreme Court nominee, Neil Gorsuch.
After Justice Scalia's death, Senate Republicans decided to let the American people in this last presidential election choose his successor. In Judge Gorsuch, President Trump chose one of the most accomplished lawyers and jurists of his generation.
Let the American people decide? Well, Democrats were pretty unhappy about what happened with Merrick Garland, who Barack Obama, President Obama, had put up for this seat. Here was Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy condemning that on Monday.
This was an extraordinary blockade. It was totally unprecedented in our country's whole history. Some liken it to the action of the tyrannical kings who claim that they have sole control.
Well, will he get a vote? Probably. Well, almost definitely. A couple of Democrats now saying, no, not until we've sorted out all this business with Trump and Russia. But here was Democratic Senate Minority Whip Richard Durbin of Illinois on Monday talking about who's entitled to what.
You're entitled to be judged on the merits. The Democrats of the Senate Judiciary Committee will extend to you a courtesy which Senate Republicans denied to Judge Garland, a respectful hearing and a vote.
And here the judge himself in opening statements on Monday rejecting the idea that judges advance political agendas.
These days we sometimes hear judges cynically described as politicians in robes, seeking to enforce their own politics rather than striving to apply the law impartially. But if I thought that were true, I'd hang up the robe. The truth is, I just don't think that's what a life in the law is about.
And he's not looking to hang up the robe. He's looking to join the United States Supreme Court. He's been talking all week, 10 or 11 hours yesterday, and again on today. Of course, he was there Monday. We're going to look at what's been said, what we've learned, what can be gleaned from this, what's not said in these hearings. Joining us now from Washington, David Savage, Supreme Court reporter for the Los Angeles Times. David, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Hi, Tom.
And with us from Washington, Dahlia Lithwick. She covers the courts and the law for Slate. Dahlia Lithwick, welcome back to On Point as well. Great to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
David, look at these hearings so far. How are they like or unlike what we've seen with previous nominees to the Supreme Court?
Well, I think they're quite like previous hearings with Justice Sotomayor, for example. She'd been a judge for 10 years. She well qualified. She was asked a lot of questions, and she frequently said, well, I just look at the law, I look at the facts, and, you know, decide from there. In other words, she said, I'm just going to be a good judge. And that's very much what John Roberts said, a version of that. Sam Alito said a version of that. And so it's similar in that sense that, you know, he goes up there and says, I've got a 10-year record. Look at my record. If you ask me a question about something of substance, I'm not going to tell you because it could affect my independence or impartiality. So it's an unusual sort of dance where the nominee he is a very pleasant, charming, you know, sort of earnest, idealistic. He's sort of calm and unruffled. He makes a very good presentation. But on the substance, he's really not telling them anything they don't already know.
Dahlia, I just look at the law. Sonia Sotomayor said that. Many others have said that. But, of course, we know once they're on the court, they have leanings, they have philosophies, they have principles. Scalia, who he would replace, was famous for that. What do we know and what are we hearing explicitly or implicitly in what Judge Gorsuch is conveying or has demonstrated about the philosophy he would bring to the bench?
Well, you know, one thing we do have that we didn't have with, say, Elena Kagan, Tom, is a 10-year judicial record. He's sat on the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals for 10 years. Mm-hmm. He is, I think everyone stipulates, a magnificent and powerful writer. He is really a forceful and clear writer. In that way, I think he really does stand on Justice Scalia's shoulders because he has a tremendous gift for being very clear about what he thinks. And one of the things that I think some of the folks who are opposing him would say is he's not just in his opinion writing telling you what his opinion is in this case. He's very apt to write a dissent. He's apt to write – sometimes he writes concurrences to his own opinions. He's very inclined to do the kind of busy work of, you know, maybe this case should be overruled. Maybe there's this other thing we should be thinking about. And so I think there is this valence, and you're hearing it in the hearings. I think Amy Klobuchar has been quick to point it out, the senator from Minnesota, that he's very clear, more so than just a judge who's calling balls and strikes, about when he thinks the law is wrong, where he thinks even Supreme Court cases need to be overturned. And so he's not a cipher, Tom. I would say you almost want to say this is a man who's been very clear in telegraphing that he has some very, very strong preferences about where things should go.
I mean, we heard from Ted Cruz, Senator Cruz, Republican of Texas, of course, about what he thought, as he put it, what the people voted for when the Republicans blocked Merrick Garland, the Obama nominee, said, no, nothing, no action on this till after the election. And here's what Ted Cruz said Americans asked for in this judge.
In what was essentially a referendum on the kind of justice that should replace Justice Scalia, the people chose originalism, textualism, and rule of law. The people chose judicial humility. The people chose protecting the Bill of Rights, our free speech, our religious liberty, our Second Amendment, rather than handing policymaking authority over to judges on the Supreme Court.
So what does that mean? Originalism, textualism, and when Ted Cruz says rule of law, Dahlia, what's he describing?
Well, I have to put in just one little coda before I answer that. It's really very fraught and complicated when Ted Cruz says, you know, the people chose and they picked that they wanted somebody who was a textualist and a devotee of original public meaning. Because you'll remember back in October, Ted Cruz also said, you know, if Hillary Clinton wins this election, we're going to keep this seat open for 4 years.
Yeah.
So the people were only allowed to choose a textualist by Ted Cruz's definition. And so he's in that sense very happy that they did. Textualism, originalism, these are Scalia vintage jurisprudential techniques. This is an idea that we can cabin and constrain judges if we force them to only look at, and there's different language for this. We can talk about original public meaning. We can talk about the text itself. There's all sorts of different flavors. But the basic idea is we want to look at what the drafters meant when they said it. We want to look at the words on the page. Judge Gorsuch was really clear yesterday. He was like, if that's ambiguous, we turn to the dictionary, but we are going to be constrained in our work by only looking at what the law intended. And this is meant to be a kind of counter-argument to the idea that justices on the other side kind of are living constitutionalists. They believe that the document must change over time and that it has to evolve with mores and values as those things change. So that's basically the playing field, Tom.
So if we run down the list of things that Americans care about here, and of course, you know, what you care about depends on where you sit. If you're a big corporation, you may have different priorities than a little guy or gal. But how does that apply, David? I mean, a lot he would not say, but he does have a record. Let's start with Roe v. Wade and abortion. Given his predilection, given his way of approaching the law, what kind of vote is he likely to be, opinion is he likely to be on the U.S. Supreme Court when it comes to abortion?
I would guess he's a skeptic of the right to abortion. And if they get a case to narrow it, I bet he's with the conservatives to narrow it. He said yesterday that he was very clear, saying, I didn't make any promises to the Trump, excuse me, to President Trump or his people on this. We didn't discuss it. He also had an exchange where he talked about precedent, and that if a precedent has been on the books for a long time and has been well accepted, it has a heavy, heavy presumption in its favor. So I took it what he was trying to say to the committees is that I have no agenda to overrule Roe versus Wade. And I take him, I mean, we don't know, but my guess is that he wouldn't go on the court thinking, at the first chance, I'm going to overrule Roe versus Wade. But suppose Lindsey Graham brought up the fact that he was going to push through the try to push through the Senate a bill to say, let's limit abortions to 20 weeks. He talked at some length about that. If that kind of case comes up to the Supreme Court, my guess is a Justice Gorsuch would say, that he'd be willing to cut back or trim back the right to abortion to some degree.
What's your evidence for saying that, David?
Because if you're, as like you were saying, discussing with Dahlia, you said, look at the original meaning of the Constitution, the phrase life, liberty, and property without due process of law. Almost all the conservatives think Roe versus Wade can't be justified under the original meaning of the 14th Amendment. So they come to it with a skepticism that it was probably wrongly decided in 1973. They also...
But what kind of principle is that? It's precedent. It's been there for decades. I respect precedent. I wouldn't overrule it, but I would narrow it. Where's the principle that's... I mean, is it respect for precedent there, Dahlia, or not?
Well, I think that, you know, he's certainly not telling us. What he's telling us is, and again, I think what David is saying is exactly right. Senator Dianne Feinstein, who's the ranking member, pushed him pretty hard on Roe, and he was willing to say it's a case. He was willing to say that 40 some times since then, it's been upheld. He didn't go much farther than that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the confirmation hearings for nominated Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch, what we know, what we've learned. David Savage is with us from the Los Angeles Times, Dahlia Lithwick from Slate. They're both covering this very closely. And you can join us this hour. What do you think? Is Neil Gorsuch, the judge, being appropriately reserved in these hearings, too coy, too concealing? What do you make of the Democrats' complaint that Gorsuch is too friendly to corporations at the expense of the little guy or gal? What about that frozen trucker? And what do you most want to know from Judge Gorsuch in these hearings? Senator Lindsey Graham, one of his fellow senators, and you, to know this is a great pick.
President Trump could not have done better in choosing you. And I hope people on the other side will understand that you may not like him. I certainly didn't agree with President Obama, but I understood why he picked Sotomayor and Kagan. And I hope you can understand why President Trump picked Neil Gorsuch. I hope you'll be happy with that, because I am.
On Roe v. Wade, some tough questioning yesterday about whether it was decided correctly. The judge simply said it's a precedent.
Roe versus Wade, decided in 1973, is a precedent in the United States Supreme Court. It has been reaffirmed. The reliance interest considerations are important there. And all of the other factors that go into analyzing precedent have to be considered.
Is it a super precedent? Ask Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein of California.
Do you view Roe as having super precedent?
Well, Senator, a super precedent is a
in numbers, 44.
It has been reaffirmed many times.
What's a super precedent, Dahlia?
I remember this exact colloquy, Tom. In fact, I think I remember it verbatim, going back and forth with John Roberts during his hearings. It's not entirely silly. The notion is, and he flicked at it there, it's different to overrule something that the court decided 2 or 3 years ago and something that the court decided decades ago. Something that the court decided decades ago, and I think Roberts about not just Roe, but Griswold versus Connecticut, the right to birth control. He talked about them as cases that they're not just precedent because it's hard to overturn them, but because after decades, you develop this reliance on them. Society orders itself with the expectation that that is the law, and then it becomes very, very tricky for the courts to overturn them. I think if you want to think about something that's not a super precedent, if it's helpful, something like Obergefell, the marriage equality case, case that is just a few years old, you know, you can sort of say, oh, you know, there haven't been hundreds and hundreds of follow-on cases where the Supreme Court reaffirmed that, so maybe it's easier to disturb it. And so I think that what Feinstein was pushing him to say, and underneath this, this is the idea that I think a lot of folks say John Roberts may not be apt to overturn Roe given the opportunity, because it's this idea that if a case has been around for decades, even if it's wrongly decided, you don't overturn it willy-nilly. And that, I think, a lot of folks say maybe John Roberts even is in that camp.
But narrow it, David Savage, you say, Gorsuch, you suspect will be quite, perhaps quite willing to do that. I mean, today he's been saying in response to Dianne Feinstein, talking about originalism, he said, no one is looking to return us to horse and buggy days, trying to interpret the law and apply it to today's problems. What about Obergefell and gay marriage? Has he spoken on that? Has he ruled on something that might be parallel or reflect on how he might look at that?
You know, Tom, I think that one is settled more by settled in American culture than is necessarily a longstanding precedent. As always said, the Supreme Court didn't decide that long ago. But I can't see any situation where a state is going to try to deny a marriage right to a gay couple. It just seems to me that's one we're not going to go back on. There may be some cases on the margin about rights for gay couples or something of that sort, where there's some litigation on it. But I don't see the court being forced to reconsider the right to marriage for gay couples. You know, had Merrick Garland been on the court, we'd be talking about Citizens United, because that's the recent precedent that the Hillary Clinton and the people of the Democrats would really like to overturn. That's the one that has really, from their point of view, had done terrible damage to the political system by allowing this flood of money that Sheldon Whitehouse talked about it at some length. And so there are precedents out there that some people would like the Supreme Court to reconsider. I just don't think the gay marriage case is one that's going to be litigated in the next couple of years.
Let's go to our listeners. Cedar in Lexington, Kentucky. Cedar, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
I want to say that I am by no means a conservative. I am not a slam dunk for Judge Gorsuch, except that I have a high respect for his willingness and ability to interpret the law in the spirit in which the law was written. I have a fondness for the English language. The Second Amendment, right to bear arms, I'm sorry, wrong, is critical. It was written at a time when the Revolution was very recent memory. It says nothing about a right to bear handguns, and I think that it should be interpreted in that way.
So you say in the spirit or even literally, but you've got a kind of a less sweeping take on it than the NRA might. Has this come up yet, Dahlia? Has he looked at the Second Amendment yet or been tested on it, I should say?
He was certainly tested on Heller. That would be the seminal
gun
case out of the District of Columbia. And he did exactly what he did with Roe v. Wade. He said, you know, Heller is clearly the law of the land, is what he said. So he's, you know, he's kind of reasserting.
But would you change it, Judge Gorsuch?
Well, and he was asked about semi-automatic weapons. And, you know, he was very careful to say, I'm not going to rule on anything that may come before me. And in fairness, it will come before him. There are a lot of gun cases teed up that the court needs to square away. I would just say one thing to Cedar, and I think that I'm not sure Judge Gorsuch would disagree with me. I think that there's actually no originalists left on the court. I think we have this notion that all conservatives are originalists and all liberals are whatever, living constitutionalists. I think that maybe Clarence Thomas is the last originalist. Scalia would say of himself, I'm just at best a faint-hearted originalist. And
what was the distinction Scalia was making when he said that?
when Scalia said it, he said, well, Thomas would overrule anything. You know, like he, you know, would go much further than I would. Scalia was much more apt to say, look, there are certain things that I may not like, but I have to live with them because time has moved on. And so I think that sometimes when we use this framing, and it's the one you read at the beginning, you know, of we've got originalists and folks on the other side who make things up. The truth is, I think Justice Breyer, for instance, uses originalist methodology sometimes. Justice Stevens famously uses them on the left. On the right, the conservative justices famously use other interpretive tools as they go. And so I think that actually this notion that all conservatives do this one thing, all liberals do this other thing, really misapprehends what actually all of the judges are doing every day, which is a little of this and a little of that most of the time.
Which, what does that mean, that there's no sort of pure line? Everybody's got an agenda of some kind? Is that what that suggests? Or everybody's flexible in their own way?
Well, that's the cynical view, Tom. I think the other view is judges have to do what they have to do. And some part of that will be trying to divine the meaning and intent of legislation. And all judges believe that that's a component of their job.
Yep.
I think all judges believe that that stops at some point being of perfect utility. And then there are other things you do. And so I don't think it's just that they're pushing their political agenda. I think that there is an array of tools they can use to divine meaning and to divine intent and to divine constitutionality, and that the notion that there is this rigid, constraining originalist, you know, hat that you put on and only conservatives put it on, and that liberals, you know, like to make things up and, I don't know, look at what the Ouija board says. I think that that's just not a helpful analysis of what anyone does at the court all the time.
Lisa in Austin, Texas. Lisa, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My biggest concern about Gorsuch is, frankly, this frozen trucker case, because I heard about it yesterday. I listened to Al Franken questioning him.
Yeah.
And because all of these Supreme Court nominees are so good now at not really answering questions, you have to look at their past decisions. And my understanding of this is that he was the only dissenting opinion on the Tenth Circuit on that case. And it seems to me that he is so rigid in his interpretation of the written law, that he would have taken that to an absurd outcome, as Al Franken said, in that case, and basically said through his decision that this poor guy, Alfonso, whatever his name was, in minus 14 degree weather with frozen brakes on his trailer, should have risked literally dying rather than, well, in order to keep his job. I mean, that was kind of the guy's decision. And frankly, that's just alarming to me that someone would interpret the law that rigidly to come up with that absurd outcome.
And yet, you're right. He was the one dissenting voice there. The court went the other way, but there was Neil Gorsuch. That was a remarkable exchange yesterday, and it's a remarkable story. And I want to put it to – thank you, Lisa. I'm glad you raised it. Dahlia and David, I want to put it to both of you. I mean, this is the story. Yes, it was Alphonse Madden was the driver. And it was very cold. He was on Interstate 88 in Illinois for a Kansas-based trucking company. Missed a refueling stop, had to pull to the side of the road. Sub-zero weather, brakes on his trailer, big semi-froze, I guess. Radioed for help. Dispatcher told him to stay put. Repair truck would come. It was hours and hours. He woke up, fell asleep, woke up. He was numb, way below zero there. And he unhooked the truck from the trailer and took off to look for help. Turned around when the repair truck came, but he was fired. And this is what was before the court. Gorsuch, in his ruling, suggesting that there was no room under the law to be sympathetic to this guy. This was Al Franken, Democrat of Minnesota, blasting him yesterday over that 2016 dissent in the frozen trucker case.
It is absurd to say this company is in its rights to fire him because he made the choice of possibly dying from freezing to death or causing other people to die possibly by driving an unsafe vehicle. That's absurd.
What would you have done, Judge? Senator Franken asked Neil Gorsuch.
Senator, I don't know. I wasn't in the man's shoes, but I understand why
he did. You don't know
what
you would have done. Okay, I tell you what I would have done. I would have done exactly what he did.
Yeah, I understand.
And I think everybody here would have done exactly what he did. And I think that's an easy answer. Frankly, I don't know why he had difficulty answering that.
Okay. Here was Gorsuch's reply.
It was an unkind decision. I said it may have been a wrong decision, a bad decision. But my job isn't to write the law, Senator. It's to apply the law. And if Congress passes a law saying a trucker in those circumstances gets to choose how to operate his vehicle, I will be the first one in line to enforce it.
Neil Gorsuch before the Senate hearing. All right, David Savage, take this apart a little bit for us, because the biggest theme of Democratic opposition here has been he's too friendly to corporations, not considerate enough of the little guy and gal. And here's the frozen trucker story. And depending where you stand, it can look like proof positive of the Democrats' critique.
Yes, it's a good example of where all the justice seems to be on one side and the law, at least as Gorsuch saw it, is on the other. This law was passed in the early 1980s. I went back and read about it, and it had a provision that was called the whistleblower provision. They wanted truckers and other people who not to be punished or retaliated against for reporting safety problems. And originally, Mr. Madden sued under this whistleblower provision that says, and his case was actually thrown out by OSHA. Then it went back before an administrative law judge who heard all the facts and ruled for him. And when it came up to the Tenth Circuit, said, we can affirm the judge's ruling for him, saying that he gets back pay. He was wrongly fired. He gets back pay. But as Gorsuch said, the law actually said if you refuse to operate a vehicle that's unsafe. And Gorsuch said he didn't refuse to operate a vehicle. He drove away in the truck, and that's not covered. So it is one of those cases that everybody looks at it and thinks you would side with the frozen trucker who was in this terrible situation, not allow him to be fired for having driven away on a freezing night. But Gorsuch, at least, you know, he said to us over and over again, I'm going to follow the law as it's written without regard to, you know, the sort of what seems to be fair or just.
So, Dahlia, is this informative about the judge's literalism, about a kind of a penchant for corporatism? How do you read it?
You know, I think it only gets you so far, and I want to be very clear that a lot of progressive writers have said, let's not hang our hat, you know, on this one.
On the frozen trucker. Mm-hmm.
On the frozen trucker. And it is an incredibly sad story. And you know, so I don't want to dismiss it. I think that there are a lot of folks who say, you know, if you're going to count noses, there's been a lot of times when he's ruled for the worker and for the, you know, dismissed woman and the, mm-hmm. you know, guy in prison. So I don't think they necessarily that it does all the work that Senate Democrats are hoping it'll do. I think that exchange revealed two things. One is if you read his dissent, he's pretty callous. He's pretty dismissive, and there's little hints of Scalia-like sarcasm. And I think that's one of the things that Franken was really bristling at. I think that the other thing that's interesting about it is it reflects, if you look at his answer to Franken, he says, look, of course, you know, he was, you know, operating instead of refusing to operate, and at some Kafka-esque level, of course you're right, but and of course justice suggested otherwise. But you go ahead and change the law, Congress. It's on you. It's not on me. My job is to interpret the law as it's written. And I think in a sense it goes to this problem, and we saw it again and again. He had a colloquy with Sheldon Whitehouse where Sheldon Whitehouse was pressing him on campaign finance. And Gorsuch kept saying, you know, you change the law. I'm not a senator. You legislate. And the problem is, of course, that the court, you know, the Senate has legislated on campaign finance, and the court struck it down. So this kind of very elegant worldview where I just, you know, call balls and strikes and you make the law, and if you don't like my call, change the law, doesn't actually reflect the way the dialogue back and forth between legislators and judges. And I think in some ways it gives Gorsuch a nice out in a lot of the cases where the results seem harmful for him to say, well, change the law. This is on you, not on me. And depending where you're sitting, it looks like he's either very principled or he's just passing the buck.
Or David Savage, is there a kind of cynical coyness behind that Jimmy Stewart demeanor?
Well, it's hard to know. I mean, he thinks he's doing the job the right way by interpreting the text of the law and sort of ignoring the big picture. But I think many people would say judges are supposed to do justice. And this didn't look like a case where there was a truly just result.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, it's important to work with someone you can trust who has your best interests in mind. With Rocket Mortgage, you get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence you need to make an informed decision. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
Hi, it's Tom. Thanks for listening to this On Point podcast. I want you to take a moment to think about the people you care about. Have they ever listened to a podcast? All this month, we're asking our listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. This one? Another one? Do it in real life or on social media, and if they don't know how to download them, give them a quick lesson. You'll be opening up a new world for them. Tell us what you're recommending with the hashtag TryPod. That's hashtag TryPod. And thanks. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the confirmation hearings for nominated Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch. What we know, what we've learned. You can join us this hour, as conservative as he may be. Is this the best Democrats are going to get? Is Chuck Schumer right? We should put confirmation on hold until the FBI and Congress sort out Donald Trump's Russia connections. Do you trust that a Justice Gorsuch would stand up to the executive branch, to President Trump, or whoever's in office? He's 49 years old. He could be there for a long, long time, Republican or Democrat. With Dahlia Lithwick, covers the courts and the law for Slate. David Savage covers the Supreme Court legal issues for the Los Angeles Times. We were talking about corporate power and money and where this judge's sympathies may lie there. And Rhode Island Senator Democrat Sheldon Whitehouse was pushing. Talked about $10 million that had been raised, dark money, we don't know whose money it is, for an advertising campaign advocating Gorsuch's nomination. And here he put that to Judge Gorsuch.
Do you think, for instance, that we on this panel ought to know who is behind that?
That's a political question for this body. And Senator, with all respect, the ball's in your court.
The ball's in your court, but the Democrat, the Rhode Island senator pushed back, saying, hey, the Supreme Court ruled in a way that dramatically changed the way politics work here.
What could be more involved in politics than to open this ocean of dark money that's flooded into our politics?
Good question. What about if that comes before the court? The court's already, Dahlia, the court weighed in here in a big way with Citizens United. Can we see anything in this judge's record that would illuminate where he might stand on money and corporations as persons?
Well, he was interesting. I thought on this, I think that back and forth with Sheldon Whitehouse was really revelatory yesterday. In a lot of ways, I think it showed that Whitehouse is trying to build a larger case about corruption and about dark money and about the results of Citizens United. That really, really Gorsuch is on the wrong side of that. Gorsuch's responses were also very, very interesting. I mean, he really was careful to say, look, you know, as I suggested before, you know, you can create new laws. If you feel that the notion that corporations have First Amendment rights offends you, then you can change that. He went on to say there are real reasons that, you know, when we have disclosure laws that force contributors to disclose who they are. Gorsuch had real solicitude for the notion that sometimes those people face real consequences. He cited a civil rights era case where the disclosure of who were donating meant real repercussions for people. And so I think he was trying to say in response to Sheldon Whitehouse, A, you're oversimplifying this. There are reasons we don't out political donors, and there are real consequences to them when we do. And B, ball's in your court, Senator. If you don't like the way these cases have come down, you go ahead and tweak it. Now, you're quite right that we tweaked it, it says Senator Whitehouse. But I, again, think this was of a piece with this notion that Gorsuch stands up for the proposition that, you know, justices have to have humility. They have to do the narrowest possible thing. They do not legislate from the bench. And so what he was trying to say is, I just interpret the law and it's on you to change it.
David, help us with a lesson in constitutional law here. Who's defending the notion that a corporation is equivalent to a person under the U.S. Constitution? Is that by congressional legislation or is that by Supreme Court interpretation?
A Supreme Court interpretation. I mean, if you want to be cynical about an area, this is the area to be cynical about. And I thought Sheldon Whitehouse, both in the first day and second day, made a very strong case to say, look, he ticked off a series of decisions and said, look, you have a situation with five Republican-appointed justices have struck down campaign spending laws, have allowed have had a series of decisions that have helped Republicans. They've allowed more money to flow into the political system. They've upheld gerrymandering. They've struck down the Voting Rights Act in part of the South. In other words, he was making a very direct point to him that this is not originalism. Nobody in 1791 thought that the free speech clause was about corporate free speech. So I thought he made a very strong complaint, in effect, to Gorsuch that this is conservative activism at the Supreme Court. And I agree with Dahlia. I mean, I didn't think Gorsuch really gave him any comfort or had any real response other than to say, well, the ball's in your court, Senator, go pass a new law. Well, they passed laws and the laws were struck down. There's a very strong view on the legal right. It's grown over the last 30 or 40 years that political money is free speech and that any restriction on campaign money is a free speech violation. So if you ask John Roberts or Justice Alito or whatever, they think they're upholding free speech. They're doing the right thing. I think a lot of Democrats think, come on, if a corporation is putting money into that's something that has been regulated for at least 100 years, and nobody thought it was part of the First Amendment. But that's one of the real stark divides, and I would bet Gorsuch is going to be on the conservative side of that split.
Is he in denial about that, Dahlia, or he just simply agrees with Chief Justice Roberts?
I don't think he's in denial at all. I think he really thinks that, as David said, this is speech. And I would go one further. I think it's really important to tether this to his views in the Hobby Lobby case. Because remember, Hobby Lobby takes what David has described, right? Corporations are people and they have First Amendment rights. Hobby Lobby says corporations are people and they have religious rights. And Hobby Lobby
allows... And they can impose those on their employees.
Well, that's where it goes one further. I mean, it's important to understand. Before the Supreme Court had decided Hobby Lobby, as we now know it.
And this is about offering what, abortion under the company-provided health care?
Not abortion. This was contraception.
Contraception, excuse me.
Were religious
owners
of corporations, of for-profit corporations, and they did not like under the Affordable Care Act. There was a mandate that said you provide certain – so it's not – abortions, it's certain forms of contraception. The religious owners said, no, we do not believe in that. We don't care, by the way, about the third parties, these women, thousands and thousands of them who will not get contraception. And don't forget, this is before the U.S. Supreme Court decides Hobby Lobby. Gorsuch is on the Tenth Circuit saying not just that corporations are people too for speech purposes, but for religion purposes. And so this is, you know, the art that David is describing here of corporations getting these qualities of personhood, it goes on to be the qualities of personhood that include religious faith. And that's, you know, a hard thing to find in a for-profit corporation. So I don't think that Gorsuch is hiding the ball here. There was a follow-on case to that that involved the Little Sisters of the Poor, and he sided with the Little Sisters. So I think he is very, very strongly in this camp that David describes.
Here he was standing by that 2013 Hobby Lobby ruling by the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals, which he was on, of course, that businesses don't have to offer employees birth control on religious grounds.
Congress has defined person to include corporation. So you can't rule out the possibility that some companies can exercise religion.
And there's the nominee, Brianna, in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Brianna, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, what do you see?
So I think it is important to appoint an originalist to the court, especially for more controversial issues such as abortion and gay marriage. I think it should be left up to the legislatures to make those decisions in order to have a strong public backing. That being said, I would support Judge Gorsuch's confirmation. And I'm also going to be curious to see if he'll get questioned on his opinion with the death penalty.
Brianna, what about you like the originalist perspective? Then what about corporations being granted or being seen as having personhood in the United States, even corporations having religious rights to exercise religious freedom?
Mm-hmm. I don't think corporations should necessarily be seen as being able to exercise religious freedom, but I do think they should be somewhat seen as granted as a personhood so their employees can maintain their rights.
Well, but this puts the corporation's rights ahead of individual employees. It says we'll decide on the basis of our religious view what we're going to offer you or how we'll interact with you, I guess, Brianna.
Well, if these corporations are private corporations, then they should have that right to express their religious freedom.
Brianna, I appreciate your call. Let's get one more right here from Randolph, Massachusetts. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I want to throw in one vote for tilting at windmills. I'm 60 years old, and I thought I was through tilting at windmills, but I've kind of calmed down over the past year over the Republicans stealing this choice from President Obama. But I have to say my blood is boiling now, and I can't. The rage is just rising with every day that these hearings goes on and I hear conversations like this. This was the worst thing I've seen anyone in government do in my entire life.
I mean, when they said, we won't have a hearing on Merrick Garland, we will wait for the November elections, this was more than a year ago now.
This was President Obama's choice. This guy, I have no disrespect for this judge, but he will always have an asterisk next to his name. I'll consider the Supreme Court for the foreseeable future to be eight Supreme Court justices and one imposter.
Kevin, a lot of people were really fuming last year over that, and it's brought a lot of it back right now. I appreciate your call as well. I mean, the opening day of testimony had a lot of Democratic senators espousing on that line, David, but I guess here we are. That's not going to have any impact, or might it?
Well, it will not determine the outcome. You know, the likelihood in most of the Democrats, maybe all the Democrats, but most of the Democrats are going to vote no, and that's one of the reasons. But it's sort of where we are. Even Lindsey Graham made the point, he didn't actually expect Donald Trump to win. That's what nobody knew till November, that not only was it going to be a delay on filling the seat, it was going to change it to from a Democratic appointee to a Republican appointee. Yeah. I don't think it's going to, in the end, change the outcome, though.
Does it change the way this works going forward, Dahlia? Or if Donald Trump, you know, is there, and he's there for another 4 years, and who knows, it could be more, are we just headed toward a very different Supreme Court? And with that, maybe a very different American life.
I think I just want to say, for one thing, that Kevin should know that there's an awful lot of people actually who are saying what he's saying. Chuck
yeah.
Schumer said it yesterday in the well of the Senate. Elizabeth Warren has said it's not just that they view this as a stolen seat, as Kevin says, but also I think now this president is being investigated by the FBI. And if last year's reasons for blocking Obama from putting someone up, which was mm-hmm. we have some question about whether he's legitimately the president because we're in an election year, I think there are legitimately questions now. That are forcing a lot of Democrats, in fact, to do the thing that Kevin says they're not going to do, which is say maybe we postpone this. So I'm not sure that some of what he's feeling isn't being communicated to senators on the Hill. And I've heard Senator Blumenthal, Senator Franken also give voice to some of that. I think that, you know, on the question of is it going to be like this forever, I think it is clearly polarized. I think that we're playing playing a dreadful game where Senator Graham says we all have to rise above this. Also, it's the Democrats' fault. The Democrats are saying we all have to rise above this. Also, you know, this is Ted Cruz's fault. So I don't know that this is going to repair itself. I think I would say in a sentence that norms, fundamental norms, were shattered last year around Merrick Garland. And I don't know that it can be repaired in a way that the court, which rests exclusively on public legitimacy, that's the only power the court has is public legitimacy. When you hear folks say there are going to be eight justices and an imposter, it almost doesn't matter what the senators do going forward. Now the damage is done.
David, think with us for a second here about the long game. I mean, we don't know what will happen with President Trump and these hearings. We don't know what will happen with this nomination, though it seems on its way to going through. If the president stays there and there's another along these lines, what another seat opens, and which certainly over a period of years could happen, what kind of fundamental changes could be coming if we get a different balance on the court?
Well, there are two long games, Tom. If Neil Gorsuch gets on the court, which is likely, the interesting thing, I think, going forward the next couple of years is, will he stand up against President Trump and the Trump administration if Trump does, as he's been inclined to do, sort of push the margins or ignore the norms? That's really going to be a big fight. I don't know what it's going to come up over. 2 or 3 years now down the road, the Supreme Court's going to be faced with a situation like during the Nixon era. Are they willing to stand up against the president? So that's one thing to watch down the road. And then, as you say, the really big fight is the next. No, is that if Justice Ginsburg leaves or Justice Kennedy steps down, then another conservative judge could tip the court pretty far to the right. And then you could get a really aggressive style of conservative activism. I'm not sure it's going to happen, but it could. And then there's a whole series of sort of liberal precedents. Roe is one of them, we all know. But there are a series of liberal precedents that then could be in real jeopardy.
Such as?
Well, you said various gay rights, and there are various gun laws. There's a whole series of issues that you can almost sort of tech off. Affirmative action, for example. If you get a more conservative court, I think they would more aggressively knock down affirmative action at colleges and universities all across the country. That's been on the target list. And there's a long list of liberal precedents that could go.
And with that, we're reminded again just how deeply into the grain of American life the high court's decisions go. Wherever you stand, it is very consequential who ends up on that bench. Neil Gorsuch, Judge Gorsuch, under questioning again today and on that rolls. I want to thank both of you very much for being with us today to lay out what we've seen so far and what may be coming. David Savage at the Los Angeles Times, it's always great to have you. Thank you very much for your insights today, David.
Thank you, Tom.
And Dahlia Lithwick with Slate. Dahlia, terrific to have you here as well. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.